Radio Vermont, WDEV, takes no responsibility for the opinions or statements made by the House Calls Vermont show host or their guests. The information provided during the House Calls Vermont show is offered only as a public service and should not be used as a substitute for obtaining any professional advice from a licensed professional.
Our house, in the middle of our street, our house.
WDEV presents House Calls Vermont with hosts Jim Bradley and Chris West. Each week, a new topic specific to building or renovating in the Green Mountains and your phone calls brought to you by R.K. Miles, a third-generation family-owned business proud to be your local building material supplier. Find a location near you at rkmiles.com. By Poly Construction, for over 30 years known for anything construction, big or small jobs, one call does it all at POLLIconstruction.com. By Ken Libby of the Stowe Area Realty Group at Keller Williams Stowe, your trusted advisor, 802-793-2002. By Curtis Lumber, with two locations in Vermont, Williston and Burlington. Request a quote for your next project online at curtislumber.com. By Sticks and Stuff and Swanton Lumber, with locations in St. Albans, Enosburg, Swanton, Derby, and Middlesex. By Shamrock Painting, painting and custom wood finishing, shamrockpainting.com. By Matt Clark's Northern Basement Systems for all things basementy, northernnefoundations.com. Your participation is encouraged. Call the listener line with questions at 802-244-1777 or toll free 1-877-291-8255. Now, House Calls Vermont with Jim and Chris.
Good afternoon, listeners, and thank you to our sponsors, and welcome again to another episode of House Calls Vermont. I'm Jim Bradley.
And I'm Chris West.
All day long, he is. We're here this
Except for that 10 minutes just after midnight.
Just after midnight, and stay away after that, or during that time. You know, there's a lot going on currently in our economy, and Chris and I have been talking about this on what best to formulate the show around this week. And with all these changes, and you consider, you know, workforce shortages, supply chain disruptions, rising fuel costs, you know, as far as what you put in your tank, but also all those yield a real economic uncertainty for Vermonters and other people around the nation. But we're also, as the temperatures are getting colder, we're barely into the heating season, and you think, where should I invest my money the best way? Especially if you're trying to keep things in control, you know, financially speaking, you want to make sure that your house is as buttoned up as possible. And what should you address first? Because, you know, I think the measures that we can recommend, it's not going to just tell you how to insulate your house, but also insulate your pocketbook from these expenses getting out of control. And so on today's show, we want to go over that with you. Some things you've heard before, some things you haven't. Sometimes you need to hear it again, especially if you're thinking about these things, on how to move forward to get that home buttoned up, weatherized appropriately, not just to be more comfortable, but once again, number two fuel oil, Chris, and also propane, dollar a gallon more than it was last year, and we've barely gotten started.
That's right. And Jim and I were just sitting here before the show started talking about the last time we saw fuel prices in this area. It was the 2012-2013 time frame. Fuel oil for your house was somewhere around $4.50 a gallon and reaching towards $5 a gallon. And we were doing energy audits for people who were making the honest decision whether or not to heat their house properly or to have food. So heat or eat was what they were actually having to deal with. And that's a horrible decision have to make. Now, there are programs in the state. If you are someone who's having food insecurity because of finances that are related to, you know, deciding whether or not to set your thermostat. I mean, we were in a house where this family was keeping the house at 50 degrees,
yeah,
walking around with sweaters on because it was too expensive. So if you are a person who has some financial insecurity in this time, there's a state program called LIHEAP, the Low Income Heating Assistance Program. If you haven't been plugged into that, please find out about it before things get drastic. There's only so much money that the state puts into that bucket every year, and so sure, you want to make sure that you're going to tap into that. And if you are a person who is living at 80% below the mean income, you should be reaching out to the weather assistance programs. There are five of them throughout the state,
mm-hmm,
and you can just do a web search, or if you're having problems problems, find it. You can send us an email at housecallsvt@gmail.com. We'll be happy to point you in the right direction.
So, you know, you might ask yourself, you do feel the temperatures getting colder. You feel
and this afternoon, they're going to drop precipitously. We're going to be in the 20s during the day.
Exactly. So be careful on those roads, too, because there is an icing advisory that we just saw broadcasted. But with that, you're thinking you're starting to feel those temperatures get colder inside the house. You're trying to turn up the heat. But you're also a little bit reticent because you say there's dollars. Yep. And, you know, I just talked to a lady the other day. She was trying to get her house retrofitted, but she found vermiculite in the attic. And so she had to have it professionally remediated.
And just to remind you all, vermiculite is in itself not dangerous. Vermiculite is something that's little kernels. They're kind of shiny, and we use them in potting soil because they absorb water and they release water slowly. So they're great for that. But back in the 1920s, all the way up to the mid-1970s, a lot of the vermiculite was being mined at a mine in Libby, Montana, which had asbestos running through it. So almost all of the insulation that you'll find in these old houses, and when we drive up to a house that's you know, earlier than the 1970s, we're like, uh-oh, first thing we got to do is check for that vermiculite, because that vermiculite is almost always an indication of asbestos contamination.
So, Chris, you know, she was thinking, okay, what do I need to do first with my house? Do I need to just throw more insulation into the attic? A lot of times all you're doing, you'd be better off just throwing it into the garage and letting it sit there until you do the right measures. Because if you don't get the house properly appointed and you're not following proper protocol with weatherization and building science, you're going to be throwing good money away. You're thinking, you have a self-rewarding feeling that, oh, my gosh, I did something right. I got my house more insulated. But you're going to see that didn't stop the icing problem, or it didn't stop the temperatures from dropping inside the house when it got colder. Why isn't this performing the way I thought it was? So if we're looking at this, we usually say we're looking at with respect to what areas to address first are the ABCs of weatherization.
Right.
Chris, what would you say that those – how would you best explain those?
So the reason that it's not a good idea just to throw more insulation up into an attic, it has to do with the building science, right? And one of my favorite questions when we're talking to people about physics at all is, what does heat do? And almost everybody will just throw up their hand and say, heat rises. And that's not right, because heat does not rise. Heat goes from hot to cold. What does rise is hot air, because heat expands the distance between the molecules, making it more buoyant and pushing up. That more buoyant air is going to rise in your house. You're heating this air in the house to keep your house warm. You're heating, even if you're using radiators, a lot of the effect of a radiator, almost 40 to 50% of that is not radiative heat, but it's convective heat. It's heating the air, and that air is going up. Well, the air is going up to the top point of your house, which is usually the ceiling of the second floor. And if air is pushing through gaps and holes into that, it's hitting that insulation, and that insulation has, if it's cellulose insulation or fiberglass insulation, if it's anything but a rigid insulation, it is not made to trap air in and of itself. It's meant to hold air once the air has been stopped from moving through it through the stack effect. So we got to make sure we do air sealing first.
Stack effect. What was that term again, Chris?
The stack effect, as in a chimney stack, right? The way that a chimney works is you have this hot air, and that hot air goes up the chimney.
Yep.
Well, the top of a chimney is open, and that's on purpose,
but a lot of attics are open too.
Like chimneys. So your house is acting like a chimney without you wanting it to. What you want to do, and we always explain it like in the winter, you want your house to be like an upside down bathtub, right? Where as that air is hitting the top of the top ceiling that we call the top pressure plane, that ceiling on your second floor, that it fills as if it was an upside down bathtub, and the hot air goes from the top all the way down. And that's the key, right? We want to stop that air from escaping through the gaps in the top pressure plane in that ceiling, and stop from moving through the insulation and out into the cold Vermont winter where it's not doing anything.
Because usually that's the area in that attic flat where, as Chris said, the most positive pressure plane, or the greatest potential for air to escape or push out exists. So usually capping that off, you're basically capping off one side of the drinking straw, if you will. So if you take a drinking straw, put it in a thing of water, you cap off one side, you pull it up out, there's no flow.
Right.
If you let go of that one side, then it's going to flow again. So you want to basically cap off the top of the attic flat. And where are the areas that are most vulnerable? Usually the attic hatch. A lot of times we've seen just one piece of fiberglass up there and no sheetrock, or just a piece of sheetrock that's not weather stripped.
I like the sheetrock with a loose piece of really nasty old fiberglass on top of it. That's my favorite.
Because you know when you put that hatch back down, it's going to be perfectly
sealed.
Yeah, definitely.
Another one of our favorites, which is a huge loss, is recessed lights.
Yeah.
Every recessed light can, if it hasn't been capped on top or if it isn't a surface mount, which is what we recommend if you're doing retrofits, is actually a 6-inch diameter hole into your attic. So that attic hatch, recessed lights, but also, oddly enough, the way that we build houses creates very small gaps at the very top. So the process of building a house is we build a foundation, we build up the walls, we put the roof rafters on, and then we build the interior rooms, and then we put the sheetrock on the ceiling. Mm-hmm. What that does is it actually means that the wood inside your walls is touching the wood on the bottom side of your rafters. And after we put the sheetrock on, there are very small gaps. Sometimes that gap is just a 16th of an inch wide. But if you take the house is 40 feet long, that turns into like 10 square inches per wall. You add that all up and we can get quite a lot of air leakage up into the attic by what we call the top plates of framing.
But then you have other trades that go and perform work up there, and that same top plate of framing, they have to have a pathway for plumbing items,
yep.
Whether it's a stack tube or pipe. You also have electrical lines, and usually I haven't seen somebody drill a hole that's just tight enough. Usually it's oversized, and so yes,
and not air sealed.
And not air sealed. Yep. You know, rarely have I found an electrician or a plumber with a foam gun. I have, but it's very rare. So they'll go ahead and make
they just keep it at home.
They keep it at home on the shelf. But you know, to your benefit as a client or a consumer, you want to make sure that you're going to have somebody, if they're performing work in your house, whether they're putting a new ceiling light in or whether they're going to be putting a new bath fan in, that they're sealing around that appropriately after they make those penetrations. And that being said, it's not just recess lights, but it's also when you have a bath fan or you have an electrical fixture with a ceiling fan below.
Yep.
Usually those boxes are up there, but they've got a bunch of holes in them for the wires to go in, and they're usually not sealed around the perimeter.
Even when they try to seal, I mean, we were at a smoke blower door test mm-hmm. a couple of months ago, and there was a builder we were working with that is very conscientious at trying to seal those. And they were still getting air leakage through that, even though they really tried very hard. So the top plate of frame of pressure plane, that top ceiling plane, the way that we ask builders to build these days is that you don't build your interior walls until you put up a pressure plane on top. And usually we're doing that with OSB. It's perfectly good material because it's not going to be in contact with moisture.
But strangely enough, modular home builders, most of them are going ahead and framing up the shell, the box. They have the ceiling joists up. Then they apply and usually glued in place the sheetrock.
Yep.
And by default, a house that we would think it would be more leaky is less leaky because this practice has been done to make sure that attic flat is properly sealed.
And you can do a very good job of air sealing with sheetrock. There's kind of a top level. You can't really get tighter than 3 air changes per hour with sheetrock air sealing, mm-hmm. but you can get there. And right now that's the code. We're coming up to our first break. I want to throw the number out there, 802-244-1777. So give us a call with your questions, your comments, your thoughts on what we're talking about, whether it's supply chain or weatherization, and we'll talk to you after the break.
Christmas Eve Then and Now by Wythe Windows. Christmas Eve Then.
And Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap.
Tighten up that kerchief. It's going to be a cold one.
It's that nasty draft from the window that's to blame.
Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash.
Hurry, I think I see something.
It's stuck.
And Christmas Eve now.
Look, it's Santa. What a clear, unobstructed view we get through our white windows. Quick, tilt it open.
Hey, Santa, it's Jim.
Those are some good-looking white tilt-and-turn windows.
I know. 8 locking points keep them air and watertight, and they're made in New Jersey.
That's my next stop. I have a new guitar for the boss.
I heard him exclaim as he drove out of sight.
White windows for all, for a house cozy and tight.
White windows, high-performance passive house windows and doors. Online at WYTHEWindows.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to this week's episode of House Calls Vermont. I'm Jim Bradley.
I'm Chris West.
And we have been talking about some of the more important things with respect to the steps that you would go through for weatherizing your home and which areas are the most important to start with. Usually, not always, but
right. This
usually.
Is a case-by-case basis, and we're generalizing here.
Yes. But usually the attic is first, and we've been talking about that in the areas that are important to seal, especially around chimneys. A lot of people don't think about this.
Yeah, we have a situation called a chimney in a chimney.
Exactly.
And that is where you have an actual chimney, the chimney that is used for bringing the gases from your combustion processes out, but then they build a surround around it, a kind of a build out, and that's usually a sheetrock build out. And what they do is when you get up into the attic, that space, which can be quite significant, is not air sealed up in the attic flat. So that's something we need to look at. I also wanted to point out, and we've talked about this in the past, that roofers, if you have parts of your attic or your ceiling that are actually slopes and you're getting a roofing job done, that's the time when you really have an opportunity to look at the air sealing there and the insulation package. So if you're getting your roof replaced, your shingles replaced, whatever, a metal roof, then you need to keep in mind that influences your thermal envelope and can influence your air sealing and durability.
And you may not get another opportunity for 10, 20, 30 years
right.
to check that again. And so just taking one piece of sheathing off would allow the insulation base to be exposed, and you can see the condition of the insulation at that time, especially if the mice have used it as a super highway.
We never find that.
No, never, never. And if there was ever adequate ventilation, if there's mold issues or whatever. So that's the time definitely to take a look at
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and we're available for that. If you have a slope ceiling, a cathedral ceiling that you need replacement of your shingles or whatever, or you're having durability issues, send us an email at housecallsvt@gmail.com or reach out to us by calling us at the show at 802-244-1777. And speaking of which, we have our first caller of the day, Christian in Underhill. How can we help you?
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Going well, thanks.
Hey, so I am looking at doing my rim joists, basically insulating them with rigid foam board. And so when I'm cutting the rigid foam board, do I want to fit the foam board perfectly in really snug, or do I want to leave a gap of some sort to get my spray gun can kind of around?
Well, you just keyed on several key things, or several things there.
Is it a 2x or an 8x8? I mean, that first of all, is it a true
what type
rim
of rim joist? Yeah. What's the age of the home?
85.
Okay.
So it's probably going to be traditional dimensional lumber, not a big box beam like
a 2x10, 2x12, something like that. Yeah.
And so with that, there's a couple things, because sometimes the products we use we think are providing an air seal, they're really not. Spray foam, single part spray foam, does do a pretty good job at air sealing, but it gives you that false sense of confidence that I sealed it really well in most cases, because you can have little gaps behind the scenes and then air can still get through.
And by single part spray foam, what Jim means is the cans that you can get at the store.
Yep. And so with that, what I've normally done, Christian, first of all, to expedite the process, instead of trying to cut each individual block of the material, I would take a measurement of the height of the bay, and usually, like, say if it's a 2x10, it's going to be 9 1/4. So I'd probably set my table saw, if you have one, at 9 to 9 1/8 inch, and then run the rigid board through, provided you're wearing an N95 mask. You run that through and cut strips. And then you can take each of those strips, which will be roughly 8 feet long, and by 9 1/8 inch tall, and you take those into the basement with a nice utility knife, and you can hold it up to the bay, notch the side of it, and then cut through and snap it, and then set that in the bay. Now, it should be tight. It doesn't have to be so rigid tight you're pressing it in there with a hammer or something like that, you know, or a block of wood. But you do want to make it relatively tight. But before you put that in there, I would recommend getting some high-performance caulking and caulking around the perimeter of the wood, of the actual joist bay, then setting in the rigid foam and doing it one more time around it on the front to seal it, just as a belt and suspenders, and you're going to get a lot better performance for the work that you're going to be performing.
In other words, what Jim is recommending, just to clarify, is that you wouldn't use spray foam there, right? You just use the caulking, get a nice, good, firm fit with that piece of I'm assuming you're using a blue board or a pink board. And by the way, if you're going to be doing that, you probably want to do more than one layer. One layer is just an R5.
Exactly.
We like to go to at least an R10 and sometimes an R15.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, what I have a R2, I have a 10, R10, it's a 2-inch
okay.
Board, and then I needed to cover it, and then I was thinking about putting another layer of fiberglass on this side towards the house.
I think you could just ditch the fiberglass at that point. The fiberglass is not going to add significantly to that. Air is still going to move through it. It's still a place that rodents like to hang out in. So you can do it. We're not telling you you can't. We're just saying that once you have that R10 in there, if it's well air sealed, you really don't need to go much beyond that.
But also, Christian, keep in mind, if it's an area that's never been insulated before, RBs, the Residential Building Energy Standards, would consider that a wood frame wall at that point. And the current standard would be definitely higher than an R10. You know, you can be
R15 is the minimum for
basement
joists.
Walls. Yeah, but the actual joist could be a bit higher to 20 to 25. So what I'm saying is here is definitely I think you're on the right path. If you use the fiberglass, and we say this to all the listeners out there, if you look up into your joist bays where Christian is looking to insulate and you see fiberglass and you see paper on the front of it, that's actually a real big fire hazard, because if you read it in some locations, it says do not leave this exposed because this paper will ignite, and it's backed with petroleum. If you pull it back, you'll see a black surface, and that's petroleum. Yep. And when it lights all too well.
Yep. So if you were to go ahead and use a fiberglass there and you wanted to use a paper-faced one in order to get a little more air sealing, then
– Or insulation.
Then we'd recommend that you put a piece of a sheetrock or something on top of that, which is kind of –
a lot
another
more
step.
Yeah. That's why a more rigid board, Christian, I think would be a better option.
Yeah.
Well, why don't I start off with just the R10 rigid board, and then we'll see what happens after that.
That's a great look and see how it performs for a winter. Go down there in the winter, check it out. You know, look for condensation, look for drafts. See if your air sealing did a good job.
And another area, Christian, just once you get that bay sealed, you also want to look at the actual sill plate. And that sill plate a lot of times has what's called sill sealer, like a foam gasket or some type of a different type of material gasket. And people rely upon that to be airtight, but it's not.
No.
And so once you get that bay filled, doing a nice bead of caulking along the junction between the wood bottom plate of framing and the concrete would be really advisable to help seal that.
And we're not trying to sell anybody's services, but this is one of the places that we consider spray foam to be a really good option, because it gets your R value, but it also allows you to go down over the mud sill and over to the top like inch to cover that place where that sill seal is probably not doing as good a job as it's purported to do.
Yeah, we have that same seal gasket there. So basically there's a huge crack on the interior side where you can see between the foundation and the sill plate.
Yeah.
But so you would caulk in all these scenarios. You wouldn't use the can of, you know, gaps and cracks expanding foam for any of this down there.
No, because I want something that's going to be more resilient. The thing about the single part spray foam, it does not give very well. So if you get any kind of movement whatsoever, it's going to break the seal, basically. It has its place, and we do use it. But
around window gaps and things like that, it's got some very good applications. And also, I just want Jim to jump in. The type of caulking that we recommend using is an acrylic silicone mix.
Exactly. It's siliconized, as they call it. And you can use a just 100% silicone. silicone if you want.
It's
as well.
Just often a little more expensive.
Definitely. But you don't want to use a painter's caulk because a painter's caulk is the low end and it's only going to last for about 5 years and then it's going to start cracking on its own. So you want something that gives and has resiliency to it. And usually you also want to look at the fact of is the gap, the size of the gap, and the types of sealant you use. Because if you have a gap that's larger than a quarter inch, then you're going to have to use probably a backer rod or, you know, if the seal sealer's there, it can act as that because that's going to be what's called a bond breaker. Because if you just try to caulk a large gap in an opening and you don't have something behind it and the caulking is only sticking to the lower and the upper surface, it's going to move towards the other side and open up the caulking. So sometimes you have to apply it twice. But if you have a bond breaker or like the seal sealer and you have that in place, usually that bead of caulking, you can apply right over it and it's going to work really well.
Perfect. Thank you all so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling. And I also wanted to point out, if you get a chance to go onto our YouTube channel, that's youtube.com/c/housecallsvermont. We have a couple of videos. One of them where Jim is showing how to air seal an outlet box using spray foam. So, that's a great tutorial. Just wanted to jump back in just before we took the call. We were talking about that the ABCs, right, of weatherization, and we're starting with the A. And when Christian calling, it brought us to the B. So
the basement.
Let's talk about that basement. Now, Vermont has a wide variety of different types of basements. We've got you know. Oftentimes, we'll go into a basement, and if the house is older than the 1930s, we're going to see what we call a rubble basement. And that rubble basement is what most people would call a stone basement wall, right? But those walls are a particular thing. They need a particular way to look at it. We also have a poured concrete wall, and poured concrete walls are great, except that when they pour that concrete wall, they have these pieces of metal that they use to attach the outside and inside pieces of the form. And after 10, 15, 20, 30 years of water touching those, they rust through.
Yeah.
And you actually have a very small hole in your wall. And there are hundreds of those things. So that's another thing. Before we do any work on a basement wall, we definitely want to make sure that we're not having any water intrusion, right? And the third type is a CMU or cinder block wall. And a lot of the cinder block walls that we see are hollow core, which means when they built it, they were supposed to, you know, those holes in the cinder block, they're supposed to fill those with concrete and sometimes even put tie rods so that you're tying the various courses.
Exactly.
And they don't do that. So if you have a hollow core CMU wall, then we need to look at a different way of insulating and working with that than we would with a CMU or a cinder block wall that has been filled. A cinder block wall that's got the core filled is as structurally sound and strong as a poured concrete wall.
And definitely, but right now we've got another call. We're going to go back to our phones. And Jeff in Berlin, how you doing today, Jeff?
Good.
I
just wanted to call in and commend you on the good information you're giving out. I've worked in the low-income weatherization program for 22 years, and
Wonderful. It's
great to for your all this info you're sharing. But I wanted to share that our state program for folks under 80%, I know you mentioned LIHEAP, fuel assistance, and you mentioned the community action agencies, but if you go to our state website, you can download an application and go to each agency's contact, and if you call them, they'd help you with the application for folks under 80% or if they receive LIHEAP, and it's the website's weatherization spelled out .vermont.gov.
Okay.
We're definitely looking for customers because our wait list is lower than normal, and we're looking for folks to work in our program, which is a great program.
Well, Jeff, thank you for calling. That's great information, and we'll repeat that. That's weatherization.vermont.gov is the website to get that application and to look for help in filling it out. I had a question that when I say something like 80% of, you know, the mean income, I'm just saying a number. Do you have an actual figure associated with that for, say, a household of four?
I can give you a ballpark. So I'm out doing some errands and I've stopped driving. I don't have that. I don't memorize the numbers, but I want to say 67,000 or less for a family of four. But sure. That website would give you that. It all depends on the number of people in the households. I want to say 67,000.
That's a good ballpark for people to be able to wrap their heads around.
What a timely call, Jeff, because, you know, when we're talking about fuel prices going up and people trying to stretch the dollar even further, this is a very timely bit of information. That did you hear, Jeff? He said that they have a lower amount of people on the waiting list, and usually I've seen some of these weatherization programs where people are a year and a half, 2 years out before they can get something, and you're saying that there might be able to get sooner, or you know, suits your service.
Our agency's wait lists are lower now. Some are down running 3 months, but definitely folks should apply sooner, as soon as they can. And we prioritize, you know, families that receive fuel assistance, families with children, elderly, et cetera. And it's VT, not Vermont spelled out. So okay. weatherization.vt.gov, G-O-V. And our agencies are ramping up, and we're looking to hire crew workers to kind of do all the stuff you're talking about. We provide a lot of training. So it's a great, great program, and it's really great to hear this stuff on the radio.
Wonderful.
Great. Well, thanks for calling in, Jeff, and giving us some more information about that. And we will push that that website later on the show as well to make sure people, if they're tuning in, that they get that.
So, you were talking about the basement and, you know, the different things about concrete block or CMUs, a concrete masonry unit is what CMU stands for, and also rubble foundations, where we have seen some real challenges is when people try to think, well, I'm just going to insulate that whole wall and it's going to be fine. And that could be a dangerous dynamic there if you do that. Usually what we recommend is insulating no more than 2 feet below grade.
On a wall like
on,
that.
On the wall. Yeah. Because what can happen is you've had this house that has been there for, let's say, decades and decades, and it's been leaking heat, or heat's been transferring through that assembly and keeping the ground outside unfrozen. It's kept it relatively warm. And so what happens is, if all of a sudden you block that heat then from getting out through the whole length or height of that wall, then you could end up having a situation where, let's say you have a really wet, like let's say today, let's say you had a lot of water on the ground, or you had a snow melt, and then you get a hard freeze right after. That's going to cause that soil that's now going to be running colder than it had historically to move and to expand. And when it does, we have seen that push in some parts of the rubble wall, or push in some of the CMUs, the concrete masonry units.
Usually the hollow core ones.
Hollow cores. So they're very susceptible to that. So what you want to make sure of is, if yes, do the work, but at the same time, only go about 2 feet below grade, and that's going to serve both purposes, because that lower part of the wall, whether that's 2 feet, 4 feet, whatever, that's going to stay relatively warm, and it's going to keep that ground from outside from freezing too much and expanding.
Right, and by relatively warm, we mean it's, you know, minus 10 outside and the ground is 50 degrees.
Yeah.
You know, so it's actually a benefit for your house. Because you're heating then, you know, you've got this delta T thing that we talk about. Delta T is the difference in temperature. If you've got a minus 10 outside and you've got 50 degrees from the ground inside, well, that's, you know, a delta T of 60 degrees. It's much easier to heat something from 60 degrees to 70 degrees, or from 50 degrees to 70 degrees, than it is from minus 10. So we like to not when we were very early days in the passive house movement here in Vermont, we were building houses with 12 inches of insulation under the slab, and because we wanted to keep the heat in the house. And what we realized as we were building these houses and we were monitoring these houses is that we're actually cutting off our connection to a heat source. That ground in the winter is a heat source. So now what we're doing is if we have a slab on grade, we're doing what's called a hump. We put a thickened edge around the perimeter, so that may be 7, 8, or even 10 inches. But the second we get under the house, when we're about a foot in, we go to like 4 inches or 8 or 5 inches of insulation, because we don't want to totally break that connection to the ground, because it is relatively warm compared to the outside air.
And as we're speaking about the basements, you know, whether it's the attic or the basement, we're also always concerned about vapor drive.
Yep.
And, you know, you're tightening up your house, and let's say you did a great job of getting that by professional or by yourself, tightened up that attic area, got the proper ventilation in that attic and everything else. But you've now sealed off a spot in that attic where, you know, granted, you're keeping the moisture from getting into the attic, so mold shouldn't occur there, or icing events like icicles on the outside. But then in the basement, if any air can leak out and air can infiltrate back in, you know, it can bring some of that moisture from the outside. Usually it's drier outside than inside.
During the winter, yeah.
Yeah, during the winter. But you also, what we see people during the summer, like open up windows or open up doors because they want to air out the basement.
We've got to ventilate our basement.
But then you're bringing in vapor, and what happens is it hits those colder surfaces, yeah, like Chris said, that are normally 48 to 50 degrees, and then you have that first condensing layer, or it drops the moisture at the dew point, and it adds to the moisture level in the basement. Another thing that adds to the moisture level in the basement, even if you have a poured concrete floor, if there's no vapor retarder or vapor barrier underneath, or you have an exposed dirt floor, you're going to have vapor drive. And you can say, well, I don't have pooling water. You don't have to have pooling water. It can still be a vapor migration from the soils up into the living space. So if you go and try to insulate that space really, really well and air seal it, and you don't address what's on the floor, you could really start creating a mold factory, because the moisture content is really going to elevate inside because it doesn't leak out as much.
Fortunately, we're in a situation where relative humidity monitors, RH monitors, are relatively inexpensive. You can get them for under $20 at a local hardware store. So if you think, oh, gee, I'm wondering if my basement has a high relative humidity, then you can just go and get a monitor and put it in there. You can get expensive ones at Datalog that'll like track, you know, months worth of that. That's not really necessary. If you're just down there and every now and then you look around and you take a look at your relative humidity monitor, you'll be able to get an idea of where that's at. And what we're looking for is below 60%. We like keeping our relative humidity in our spaces above 30% and below 60%, or like in that, we call that the sweet spot. Once you get above when you get into the 70% range, a piece of wood that's exposed to moisture in the air that's 70% or above, is going to start being susceptible to mold and mildew
and rot.
Wood rot, right? Yeah. And those are the things we have to worry about. So the reason that we were in the attic at the beginning of the show. We're talking about air sealing the attic and the top pressure plane. Well, the top pressure plane is only part of the story, because when you have the air leaving that attic space, it actually depressurizes the house. Mm-hmm. And that has to re-infiltrate. We have to re-infiltrate
balance.
And balance, because yep, nature likes things to be in balance. So if you have a low pressure, that's going to be sucking air in somewhere. And where the largest pressure differential is going to be furthest away from where that air is leaving. And that's going to be in your basement. So we start with the attic, and then we go to the basement. And what we want to make sure with that basement is that we're reducing the reinfiltration there, because that's going to be freezing outside air. And depending on the season, right now, mm-hmm, we're in the shoulder season, right, where it's sometimes wet and sometimes, you know, above the freezing, sometimes below. If it's above freezing or just below freezing, that air can be full of moisture. And you're bringing that air into the basement, and that's coming through your house. So the second thing we want to do is air seal that basement, the perimeter joist beam, that perimeter joist bay area, or, you know, if you've got a basement door, if you have a bulkhead door, has got to get looked into.
We've seen some things really cobbed together because,
Cobbled.
Yeah, well, Vermonters are very resilient and independent in many ways, but one of those ways is, how can we creatively build a basement bulkhead door and not insulate it, not weather strip it, and wonder why all the rodents keep coming in? You know, so getting – a lot of times I've taken out some of those really poorly performing doors and get a custom-sized exterior door that's insulated, weather strip, and so you can say, well, I don't have enough room for a traditional door. They make customized doors, so you can get a really robust assembly, have that installed appropriately, whether it's a rubble foundation or a concrete block or a poured concrete.
Yeah.
You could still get a really effective bulkhead door put in there. So you're not just trying to say, well, I always get air leaks. I put some tape up there and I try to seal it this way, but then, you know, you just deal with it. Another good indicator in the basement, when you walk around, this is true for really anywhere in the house, if you see a lot of cobwebs in your basement, usually that's going to be indicating where air is infiltrating or coming in from outside. And why is that? Because spiders are smart. They're instinctive. They know if there's air movement, something's going to be flying in that airstream that they're going to use for their meal. And so that's a good indicator for us. You can get tens of thousands of dollars equipment, but you can also look on those very simplistic, rudimentary things. Where are their cobwebs? And a lot of times when you if you have a house and you can turn on your dryer or turn on your bath fans and you see more movement around those cobwebs, or if you have a windy day and you see movement around those cobwebs, they're telling you that, hey, air is coming through this area and that's where you need to seal things up. Keep in mind, though, with a basement, as we were told one time, there's only so many types of basements in Vermont. Really, there's so many types, and not one size fits all here, okay? One size may fit most, but not all, when you look at how to properly address the basement, because sometimes we've seen where people would take two-part spray foam and use that on a historic 8-inch by 8-inch box beam on one of these types of homes, and then they accelerate the rot, because what they've done is they've shut off one of the drying planes that traditionally has functioned for sometimes over 100 years. But once you seal over that and you couple that with on the outdoors, you have water getting behind the siding or the trim board, then it's saturating that beam, and where it could usually dry to the inside, it can't any longer. Yep. And so it could exacerbate a rotting situation. So once again, every house is a little bit different. There's a lot of similarities, but that's why getting it looked at professionally and not just saying, okay, they say use this, so I will, but you don't give me any other further thought to it. So it's just properly it's important to properly have your home assessed and a proper work scope developed. And we have Forbes in East Corinth. Forbes, good afternoon.
How are you, gentlemen?
Doing well, sir.
Just share with you, I had an 18th century story and a half cape, New England cape, set on old stone walls and everything else, and I jacked it up 9 feet in the air, blew everything out from underneath, poured in new walls and sill plates, and set the building back down. But when I did the walls, I did a curtain drain, of course, around the whole perimeter.
Sure.
And then 2 inches of blue board,
okay,
tongue and groove, and then 18 inches in back width of dead sand. The backfill was completely dead sand, no earth whatsoever.
Okay.
So well draining, we would say.
Right, right, with a curtain drain, of course, in case anything did go to it. The three sides are underground, and then I did radiant heat in the floor with expansion joints around the perimeter of the foundation. And I can heat this place. It's 2,100 square feet with a match.
Yeah, nice.
And the walls are, I have a soapstone downstairs.
Okay.
But you can go up to the walls and put your hands on all the walls all the way around. They're all warm.
Below grade, we're talking about, right?
Three walls.
Yeah. And to be clear, Forbes, it sounds like you took the insulation board and put it to the outside of the wall and not the inside. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
Yep. 2 inch tongue and groove.
Sure. Yep.
That sounds like a good solution. I think at this point, just because it's more recent, code would ask you to go to 3 inches. But a thermal break is really what we're looking for there,
definitely,
right? I think, just to quote my good friend, Jeff Gephardt, the first inch does the most lifting when you're dealing with insulation board. So it sounds like you did a great job there, Forb.
Well, I think the dead sand did it.
Yeah, you definitely have a really good drainage plane there. There's no water going to sit in there. It's going to get right down to your perimeter drain and be evacuated. So as long as you keep that dry, that'll certainly help.
And Forbes, one thing that you did that others may not, but they should, is making sure that drainage is effective, because when hydraulic pressure comes in and you have water pushing against that type of insulation board and you don't have a coating over the top, it will slowly migrate into the actual rigid board. And after 10 years, it may be about an inch into the product and it doesn't release easily. And so you've switched the insulator to a conductor.
Right.
And so once it's saturated and wet, it doesn't perform well. So to ensure that either you have a coating over it or you have proper drainage or both is really important. It sounds like that's what you did.
It sounds like you did a great job.
I used Block Bond. What I did is I coated all of the outer walls with Block Bond.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And that's sealing any open spots whatsoever or tie-ins.
Right. No, that sounds like you really understood what was going on and you did a great job. Thanks for the call.
Okay. Have fun.
Thanks.
Great show.
So, Chris, you know, we were talking a little bit about vapor drive and definitely why that's so important in the basement. You know,
Yeah. So basements are very tricky places, right? This is a place that without proper, to use Jim's word, appointment, we're going to have issues with moisture because it's below grade. Moisture is an issue. I mean, there are places in the world where you could be in Phoenix and you could build something underground and not have to worry about moisture for the most part. But then again, that is what we call a desert, and moisture is very low there. But here in Vermont, I remember when I first moved here and I was looking into building what's called an earthship, which is a rammed earth structure. And I was told, you're out of your mind for building that in Vermont just because the moisture is so high. And recently, just this week, we heard a new report that in the last 15 years, we've gotten much wetter here in Vermont, warmer and wetter. And so that's not going to go away anytime soon. So when we're looking at basements, the most important thing when you go into a basement is that you're controlling your moisture. And the biggest issue usually isn't the walls. It's usually the floor. And we've been in houses, in just a couple of houses the past couple of months, where they did not have any kind of moisture barrier on the ground. And so if you're building a new house and you're going to have a slab poured, make sure you have a vapor barrier under it. We like going with a good, robust vapor barrier, a good 10 mil. But if you don't have that and you've got a dirt floor or you've got a stone floor, like, you know, crushed stone or peat stone, we use a product, like a 20 mil product that's reinforced. We use a product called Silverback, which has got a silver lining on the back of it, which is antimicrobial. And that reduces the ability of moisture to get around that and into your basement, which, of course, we've already said, reduces the relative humidity, which increases the durability.
And that's usually a product that you're going to want to use if you're a DIY type of person, because if you're going to have it professionally done, you know, definitely call somebody like Matt Clark from Matt Clark's Northern Basins, you know, because he definitely is very well adept at providing a proper drainage plane, a proper protective barrier that's also an antimicrobial type of feature, and a sump pump, an integrated sump pump that when moisture does get in, it's a triple safe. So it has a primary pump, a secondary pump, and then a battery backup pump. So you make sure that you'd never have a flooding issue inside your basement.
Even if the power's out.
Exactly.
Right.
So, but with that, you know, the products that are available, and what's important is we've seen so many basements and crawl spaces where somebody made an attempt at putting the moisture barrier down, and they went down to the local hardware store and got the thinnest of plastics, threw it down there, and it's been disturbed, and it's not really even effective. It's really a jumbled mess, and it's not performing well.
We have a call. We want to go to. I just want to finish this one point. The term we're looking for is contiguous.
Yes. Integrated.
So we want if you buy sheet plastic and that sheet plastic is only 15 feet wide and you have a 30 foot wide basement, then you need to overlap the where the two pieces meet and use a tape that's not going to fail, and then you also need to go up the walls a couple of inches to make sure that you're creating a good moisture barrier. So to the phones now, we have Jack in Orange. Jack, how can we help you today?
Good. I'm kind of living in a place the opposite of Forbes. I bought a barn back in '86. It was meant to be a horse barn. It's a slab floor, and it's a 2x6 gambrel construction.
Okay.
So it's a story and a half. So I'm living upstairs in it, but my ceiling is the ceiling. You know, there's no more attic space above my head.
Yep.
So I insulated it all with the fiberglass stuff of the day. I moved up here in '91. I insulated it with like R13. It's all 2x6 construction.
Yep.
So I did it all with that. But it's obviously not enough. Now, I don't really have saw. I left an air gap between the insulation and the wall, thinking my soffits would vent up there. But I was told by a guy not to do that and to stick another layer of insulation in there. And to cover it with plastic, is that true or no?
So first of all, we don't use plastic in our walls. We've abandoned that as a strategy. Gambrels are a very particular and interesting type of construction because you've got these kind of walls that are slopes. As you're going up, and it does that twice before it reaches the peak of the roof. In general, when we're talking about a wall, we like venting our walls, but we like venting our walls outside of the studs, right? We call that a rain screen. But that requires residing, and that's a big job, right?
Yep.
If you have, just a regular 2x6 bay, and you want to insulate that, you can fill that bay with an insulation, with a fluffy insulation. We'd prefer that we look at the first condensing layer and we try to make sure that the first condensing layer is going to be above the dew point, but that's not always possible. And if that isn't possible, and by that I mean, do we want to put some rigid in there and then some fluffy, right? 50% of the R value rigid, 50% fluffy. There's something called a flashing bat. So if you were to have access to all of your exterior walls and you didn't want to pull the siding off and put rigid on the outside and build a rain screen, one good way to do that is to spray foam the first 2 inches of that bay and then fill the 3.5 inches with fluffy, or fiberglass or Rockwool or something like that. And then on the inside, we'd put a vapor control layer, and it's not plastic. It is a vapor open, vapor closed membrane. There are a couple of products on it called a variable vapor open, vapor closed membrane. What that does is it reduces the ability of moisture, just gaseous water in the air, from migrating into your wall. And at the same time, when the vapor drive changes in the summer, when there's more, you know, when it's moisture outside than is inside, we have the ability to dry to the inside. And that is an okay assembly. It's not ideal, but it is okay.
And Jack, I think you were also talking about your concerns isn't just your walls, it's also the roof line itself. And that is a 2x6 assembly, if I understood you correctly.
Yes, okay. It is. Yeah.
And so with that, what makes it difficult on a gambrel is how do you get that continuous ventilation, because you're changing geometry. You may be able to come up from the soffit, but then does it make that first slope and then turn?
Second
and
float, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So making sure there's adequate ventilation that's unobstructed is really important.
And which part do you call the roof? At what point is that slightly bent? Is that a wall roof? Is it a roof wall?
No, it's just a roof. It goes up from the bottom. It's all roof. It's a storage on the edges. Let's put it that way.
I get you. Okay.
I can bend over, and standing up is standing up. But it's all one roof.
Understood.
So it's all just the regular fiberglass insulation that's stapled in there, you know?
Yeah.
Well, one thing I think is really important, sometimes I've recommended to people, if they're going to try to trust what's in there now from 91, is still performing well, you could put insulation on the underside of the sheetrock and then re-sheetrock. You could do something like that. Or you may need to approach it again from the outside, which is more exhaustive, more expensive. I get that.
But we'll definitely get you a more durable and well-vented assembly into the future.
And then you'd be building up on top of the 2x6 with insulation and possibly some more structure, but more so to support additional insulation. One thing I think would be good, Jack, because we're actually coming up really near the end of the show, is go to our website or our email, and we'd like to continue this conversation, especially if you're thinking about making some of these changes. Chris?
So the email is housecallsvt@gmail.com. And one of the times that we'd want to do this type of retrofit is when your shingles would need to be replaced. We don't know where you're at that, but we'll get deeper into that during our email conversation. And we appreciate you calling in, Jack.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
You're welcome. So, Chris, you know, the one area that we did have that we haven't gotten to yet, and these topics continue to grow, if you will, because we didn't get exhaustively into everything, but definitely there's essential areas of the home. So we've addressed the attic. We've addressed the basement. There's a lot more measures that we could talk about in both those areas, but we then look at the central areas of the house. Usually why those are less important to address right off is going to be because it's the neutral pressure plane.
Right.
You don't have the extreme of the positive pressure at the attic or the negative pressure, drawing air in from the outside.
Due to
the stack effect. So the central areas are a little more neutral, and that changes or moves throughout the building as you turn on bath fans or dryers or whatever. But with that being said, if we really affect a lot of changes to that central area, sometimes, as Chris just mentioned, you may be taking off siding to get new insulation in there and a rain screen or whatever. But in most homes, you can affect a lot of changes in the central areas by addressing things like caulking of window trim, and all planes of that window trim, not just one side where it looks like it's open, but above or below. I challenge the listeners right now to go to one of their windows and reach above it and see if you can't feel an eighth inch to a quarter
inch gap.
The top
of the trim.
Because what a lot of people do is you'll never see it. Why caulk it?
Right.
Well, you caulk it because you want to stop that air from coming in. We see that time and time again. Or lay down on the floor and look at the underside of the trim, and you're probably going to see the same type of gap. And this is true around door trim for exteriors. You also can look at the weather stripping on your doors. The the weather stripping on your windows. You want to see if those are in good repair, and you don't want to just keep building up more and more weather stripping and another layer and another layer. You want to get it back to the original baseline and put the right type of weather stripping in, whether it's a Qlon type product that's Q-L-O-N that can
get Did I say QAnon last week? I think I said
he
QAnon.
He did. You can apply that to the door frame on most exterior doors, and even if your door is a little bit warped, that will still be a very effective type of weather stripping. But you also want to call your window manufacturer and see if they have replacement weather stripping, and there's definitely online sites that for your window trim or for your windows that are older that may not even be in business anymore, the manufacturer.
If you go to our YouTube channel and you look at our episode from last season on windows, you'll find the links to Pitkins Windows Service.
You can actually send them a small sample of your weather stripping, and they'll match it.
Right.
And then you can order the amount you need, and it's an easy change out to make your windows more efficient. You also want to make sure you have proper sash locks on your windows and that they're locking, because people think that's just for security. But if you don't lock that, it doesn't pull the sashes together to make them more
airtight.
Doesn't
engage the actual gasket, right?
Yeah, and we also look at, you know, baseboard around the exterior walls, that those are caulked appropriately, because that's a source where air can infiltrate. And we also look at outlets, light switches, and things like that, because what happens in those areas, they're not sealed in the wall. And like I said earlier about the drinking straw effect, they're one part of that opening, and they can allow a lot of convection to happen inside the wall, and you get cold coming in or heat loss. And so addressing those areas, we do have a video on the website, like Chris said, on how to do that.
Yep.
But you got to be really careful too, because that's an electrified spot. So usually a professional takes care of that. But right now we do have
one last call with Jack in Moscow, and I want to thank Joel for letting us go a little over today. Jack, how can we help you?
I got a mudding question. I did these corners. Cleaned it out real nice. I had maybe like a 2-inch gap, and I filled it with mud, and I was real happy with myself. So I didn't lay down any tape, and then I mudded it again and a third time. Am I just kidding myself, and it's all going to crack in a year or so, or did I? Is it going to stay looking as good as it looks right now?
Yeah, that's the unfortunate part. When you're talking about sheetrocking, there's a tape. There's a reason why they want you to use tape, why you should use tape, because of that very thing. You're going to get movement. You're going to get shrinkage. There's going to be different moisture levels, and there's going to be movement there, and it will crack. That's why that tape bridges the gap. In that situation, though, it may look nice right now. You can still go back, and I know it's extra work. There's definitely some great tapes out there. Some are your traditional paper tapes that are going to be pretty thin. There's another one out there that's more of a mesh, not a fiberglass mesh, because that thing sticks out too proud. But another type that at the hardware stores, Lowe's has it as well, but it's almost a see-through type of product. But that can go, and if it has a very low profile, so that you can actually mud over that with very little effort. But certainly, if there's not a bridge between the mud and the sheetrock, it will eventually open up, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's why they call it taping, I guess. All right, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling in, Jack.
Well, and for today, that's what we had for House Calls Vermont. But Chris,
I do want to jump in and just give that website again that Jeff called in with, weatherization.vt.gov. If you're interested in finding out more about the weather resistance assistance programs and applying, and if you have questions about applying on that website, there is a phone number you can call. They'll walk you through the application process. And they've got capacity. So if you're someone who is in the right economic range for that, this is weatherization that's done free to you. This is something that the state is paying for. So it will reduce your fuel bills. It'll make you more comfortable. It'll increase the durability of your house.
And Chris, to quote Randy Quaid from Christmas Vacation, Clark, it's the gift that keeps giving all year long. So once you get the house weatherized, it's going to be comfortable in the winter, comfortable in the summer, and it's a great way to save money.
I can tell you were practicing that in the shower this morning. Thank you very much, Jim. This is Chris Best from House Calls Vermont. Until next time.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
House Calls Vermont, brought to you today by R.K. Miles, a third-generation family-owned business and proud to be your local building material supplier. Find a location near you at rkmiles.com. by Poly Construction for over 30 years, known for anything construction, big or small jobs, one call does it all. P-O-L-L-I Construction.com. By Ken Libby of the Stowe Area Realty Group at Keller Williams Stowe, your trusted advisor. 802-793-2002. Curtis Lumber, with two locations in Vermont, Williston and Burlington. Request a quote for your next project online at curtislumber.com. Sticks and Stuff and Swanton Lumber, with locations in St. Albans, Enosburg, Swanton, Derby, and Middlesex. And by Shamrock Painting. Painting and custom wood finishing, shamrockpainting.com online. And by Matt Clark's Northern Basement Systems, for all things basementy, northernnefoundations.com. And be sure to join us next Saturday at 12:30 during the noon hour for House Calls Vermont on WDEV.